Hello, Boils and Ghouls. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you all for your donations to our fundraiser. We've made some great progress, and it's all thanks to you. We still have a little bit to go, so if you're able, please head to www.helpchilling.org to contribute. By doing so, you're helping us continue to make the world a bit spookier. Now, on to the show.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator, and I just happen to have two chilling tales for you right here, all queued up and ready to roll. Both of tonight's stories come to us courtesy of Velux Books, so be sure to check out their site for some great horror compilations. Tonight, we'll begin with Not a Cat Guy by Cassandra O'Sullivan Satcher. Our story opens with a young man, Jason, at a bar, telling the bartender his tale of woe. It turns out that Jason has just been through a rather turbulent relationship, though in this case, the domestic strife wasn't caused by normal factors. Along with his new girlfriend, Jason tacitly adopted Jacques, a black cat that might have a bone to pick with him. After that, we'll round things out with When Dusk Falls by T.W. Grimm. This tale gives us a bird's eye view of Hadley Township, a gorgeous stretch of forests and farmlands in Middle America. From our aerial view, we check in on the lives of several residents of Hadley, and in doing so, learn that things are a little different than one might expect. Yes, Hadley is beautiful and peaceful, but it seems that those things don't come free. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Cassandra O'Sullivan Satcher, I give you Not a Cat Guy.
Hey, man. Yeah, I'll have another. Got a minute? There's something I need to get off my chest if you're willing to listen. Thanks. So, I started dating this woman, you know. Not a girl, but a real woman. Hot, smart, total wife material. I'm in my 30s now, so I need to be done with those party girls. I want someone to do real grown-up shit with, like go to my nephew's birthday party or dinner at the boss's house. A woman. And then I meet Amber through a friend of a friend, and I figure she could be the one. Things are going great for a while. Slow, but whatever. She's been married before, but then her husband died like a year before I met her. That's how I got lucky and scooped her up. This chick totally out of my league. It turns out she was just putting herself back out there. Probably could have gotten a better looking and more successful dude than me if she'd waited longer. She wasn't even on the apps yet. Man, Amber's the real deal. Like, the first woman I dated who has opinions on stuff that matters, like politics and human rights and shit. She's just herself, you know? Unashamed to admit she enjoys reality TV and doesn't like watching sports or going to museums. She says she works all the time and is going to do whatever she wants when it's her time. She says life's too short to do only what other people tell you. We go through our honeymoon, getting to know you phase and hash some shit out. She says she's afraid to let her guard down around me after being epically wounded by her husband's death. And I make the mistake of saying, I don't mind damaged goods, trying to keep it light, but that does not go over well, more like a fart at a funeral. At that point, I haven't been to her house yet, and that all comes out. We'd been together a couple of months by then, but we'd always gone to my place. But we're solid, so we both apologize for what we said. Before I know it, she invites me over for this romantic dinner. And that's the night I meet him. Amber mentioned she had a cat, and I'm not a cat guy, but I don't really care one way or the other. He's a rescue, an older kitten she adopted from the local shelter like 6 months before we met. No big deal to me, since I'm not allergic. I'd just rather hang with a dog. So, the night of, I put her address in my phone book and drive like half an hour from my place to this fancy-ass neighborhood. A tree-lined cul-de-sac with brick and stone houses and a big sign announcing the swanky place. Thistle Grove. And I'm thinking that thistles are weeds, but still, it's the whole nine. And I'm feeling a little insecure, if you want to know the truth, with me living in a townhouse and the kind of restaurants I've been taking her to. But whatever. I'm here to check out my girlfriend's digs. I thought I was all suave buying her flowers. Just a bouquet of daisies I picked up while getting some wine for dinner at the grocery store. And then I realized that both the flowers and wine are cheap and tacky. But I suck up my pride and head up the elaborate hardscaped walkway. Amber swings the door open before I even reach it, wearing a low-cut black dress that I'm already imagining curled up on the floor of her no-doubt glamorous bedroom. She puts her arms around me, even though mine are full, and plants a soft, wet kiss on my lips. So I let go of my doubts and walk right on in. Amber's giving me a tour of her place, and I'm feeling like a total schmuck when she pulls out this crystal vase for my pathetic flowers, which look like crap in her tasteful foyer. Probably foyer or whatever. And I'm wondering if I'm good enough for her. But then I know I'm not by the time we make it to the dining room, where there's this huge-ass wooden table that I know isn't from IKEA or Target, like pretty much all my furniture. And it's all laid out with dinner plates and real cloth napkins, like it's a wedding, or at least a prom or something. And the smell is incredible, like I died and went to heaven. But then that starts me thinking about her dead husband, the only reason I'm here in the first place. Not gonna lie, I kinda peeked around for his picture when I was oohing and aahing over all the art and hardwood floors and shit, and I don't want to be obvious. Like, how can I be jealous of a dead man when I'm the one who's gonna take Amber to bed that night? And I think I see a picture of her in a white dress with some dude, but it's not like a rule that she has to put photos of her dead husband away just because her new boyfriend's over. So I'm busy trying to act normal and appreciative of her effort, since I know Amber doesn't like to cook, but she still made this awesome fettuccine Alfredo and garlic bread anyway, and now I'm thinking I look like a clown slurping noodles off this fancy silverware. So I tell her about the cheap wine being from Chile, and how my buddy Derek and his wife went on a trip there and no one ever heard from them again, even though both sets of their parents went down there and launched a GoFundMe. I even donated a couple $100. I miss that guy. And I find myself getting upset talking about it, wondering what happened. But then Amber's slender fingers are stroking my shoulder, making me feel better. But that's when he comes sauntering in and jumps right up on the dining room table. Amber starts shooing him away and apologizing, and I'm kind of skeeved out that a cat's sitting right by the garlic bread after he might have just been messing around in his litter box. But I don't want to be difficult when she's been so sweet and gone to all this trouble for me. I say it's fine, and the fucking cat stays there, his ass right on the table, and glares at me with those green eyes. Amber's like, "This is my baby, Jacques." I hate when people call their pets their babies or their fur babies. It's a cat or a dog, not a baby. She gets into this whole thing about the darkness she felt after her husband died, but then she adopted the cat and he helped her find joy again. Trying to be a good guy and thankful that this furball perked her up, I go ahead and give the dude a little pet. I figure that he helped her get ready to meet me, so I should be grateful. But the asshole swerves his head around like in The Exorcist and sinks his fangs into the meat of my hand. I don't want to act like a wuss or harm him, but he does not let go, and it hurts like hell. Amber starts freaking out, and I'm trying not to scream or flail him around, but then Amber finally pulls him off me, and I'm dripping blood straight into my pasta. The cat runs out of the room after fixing me with this death stare. Amber's all over it, running around with bandages and hydrogen peroxide, and I try to act chill, but that fucker was surprisingly strong, and the punctures look and feel deep. Not to mention he has a mouth full of bacteria, so I'm picturing my hand swelling up with green pus and needing to get amputated. But then I'm bandaged and cared for, and we're in the bedroom with our wine. And Amber feels so bad that she's giving me extra attention, rubbing my shoulders and taking off that dress and kissing my neck. And I kind of feel like my injury might have been worth it. Afterward, we're nodding off in her big, magnificent bed. But then I jolt awake to this scratching sound at the door. Really irritating, like fingernails on a chalkboard. In the moonlight streaming through the window, I see that fucker Jacques sneak into the bedroom. He jumps up on the bed and curls right up on Amber's chest like he didn't go all cat Cujo on me. She's sound asleep by now and doesn't even register him, but I'm not messing around. I pull myself all the way to the edge of the king bed, putting as much distance between us as possible, and I swear he smiles at me, but not a nice smile like he wants to be friends, more like he's laughing at me. But I somehow go back to sleep anyway, even though I'm a little nervous, to be honest. When I wake up in the morning, before I even open my eyes, I'm aware of being watched and of a pressure on my chest. Sure enough, that bastard sitting right on top of me, staring into my eyeballs like he's figuring out how to end me. Amber's awake too, smiling at us. "I think he's sorry," she says, giving him a pat. This tremendous growl starts inside of the cat, and I'm waiting for him to lash out, waiting for new pain, for his claws to slash me across my face. My wounded hand stings in sympathy for whatever comes next. "Relax, Jason, he's purring," she says, sensing my discomfort. "Pet him." As much as I don't want to, I don't like disappointing Amber, so I do, hoping Jacques doesn't want to upset her either. And, I have to admit, that black fur is soft and silky under the fingers of my good hand, and he is kinda cute, but I won't forget what he did to me. He gives me this long, slow blink like he's trying to tell me something, but I don't speak cat, and Amber's gushing away. Before I know it, she's confessing her love for me and asking, "Do I want to move in?" We push the cat out of the way, him with a departing hiss directed at me even though I was just being nice to the little fella, and I swear that creep watches us the whole time we make love. But I look at Amber and remind myself how lucky I am. Amber leaves when we're done to take a shower, and soon Jacques jumps back on the bed, greeting me with another hiss and squinting his eyes like he wants to rip the skin off my face. I scowl back, but Amber's walking back into the bedroom with a towel on her head, and the cat slinks away. Fast forward a month, and my townhouse is on the market, and I'm moving my shit into Amber's place, giving away or taking all my chintzy furniture to Goodwill, since it's not going to fit in with her classy stuff. The cat is still screwing with me whenever Amber's not looking, growling and swiping at me, throwing up in my shoes, I shit you not. But it's like we have a truce whenever Amber is around. He doesn't mess with me, and I don't mess with him. Not that I really do anyway. He's just a cat, but I glare at him and tell him to fuck off occasionally. And then Amber goes on this business trip for a few days. She works at Sampson Green & Associates. You ever heard of them? Anyway, it's just the cat and me in her huge freaking house, and I'm in charge of feeding him and cleaning the litter box and stuff, which feels weird since the cat and I don't even get along, but she said she needs to be able to trust me to take care of him. I briefly consider hiring the teenage boy next door to do it, but I chicken out, imagining Amber upset with me if she finds out. So, she's gone, and I'm basically the cat's bitch now, feeding him this fancy gourmet food in his crystal dish like he's the king of cats. And Amber wants me to send a picture every day so she knows he's okay. I play along, trying to catch him sleeping so he doesn't hassle me, but we give each other a wide berth, more or less. He knows he needs me to give him food, and I know I need to be nice so Amber doesn't heave me to the curb. But I swear, he's still playing mind games with me. He wakes me up wailing at like 5 a.m. the first morning, when he knows I'll be up for work in an hour anyway, and I go down to the living room to see what's the matter, like if he caught a mouse or something. He shuts up when I get there, so I turn on the light, not sure what to expect, and I see he's knocked down a picture frame, broke the glass and everything. I put on some shoes so I don't cut my feet, and I pick up the picture, and it's actually the wedding picture, Amber's wedding to her first husband, Greg. Call it my ego, but I never took a good look at it, didn't really want to act like he'd existed. But I'm forced to look now, my eyes still adjusting to the light, but that's when I see that this homeboy Greg has jet black hair and these light green eyes glowing out from the picture. And as I'm looking at this picture of the dead man who used to live here, this guy Amber loved before she even knew I existed, the cat starts making this weird noise, this chirping sound. I don't know what to make of it, so I replace the picture, clean up the glass, and go back to bed, but I can't sleep. I keep thinking about Greg, wondering what he was like, and thinking how, if he'd lived, I wouldn't be with Amber. And I kind of feel shitty for admitting this, but I'm glad he died. Amber comes home the next day, and I have to tell her about Jacques knocking down and breaking the glass, and I feel weird, since we never really talked about her ex. "He's not my ex. He died," she reminds me, and I'm chastened and shamed, and I don't know if she thinks I'm the guy who knocked it over instead of the cat, and maybe he was trying to get me in trouble. But now that we're kinda talking about the not ex-husband, it's like the ice is broken around the subject, and she brings him up more and more. Like, Greg used to do this, and Greg liked that. And I'm feeling less and less adequate, since this guy was handsome and basically a genius theology professor at Blackthorn University, not to mention loaded, like old money loaded. And I'm just an average-looking dude from Jersey who sells insurance. And she asks me to help her take some of his old stuff to Goodwill. He had all these books his family doesn't want and Amber didn't want either. So, I'm already living in the house this guy's money bought and shtupping his wife, so I figure I might as well go through his books to see if I can make sense of them. I'd like to think I'm not a total dumbass, but I can't make heads or tails of them, all these religious textbooks. But I see this one that looks interesting, like almost homemade, with this weird leather cover, no title or author on it, and the inside's all crinkly and old with faded writing that looks handwritten. No way it came from a regular bookstore or publisher. And Get this. It's all about reincarnation. And I know that fits in with his research or whatever, but it's also about how you can make yourself come back after you die. Most of it's over my head, and my hands feel tingly from touching it, like it's enchanted with black magic. So I get kind of spooked and make sure it's in the first box to head out of the house. And that's when I think back to Greg's picture from their wedding, how he had black hair and green eyes. And I'm thinking about all of this as I look up and see the fucking cat staring at me with a smug look on his face. I know it's crazy, but it all starts coming together, and I think back to how long ago Greg died and when Amber got the cat, and how old the cat was when she got him, and also how he hates me even though I've been feeding him and cleaning up after him. So I stare him right in the face and ask him if he's Greg. I'm half expecting him to open his mouth and talk to me, but he just lifts up his leg and starts cleaning himself, which I'm pretty sure means fuck you in cat language. So I start doing some deep diving on the internet, looking up stuff about Greg and how he died, which I never asked Amber about because I wanted to respect her privacy and what she shared with her husband. But if the husband's actually Jacques, then I need to be able to protect myself. I find out Greg had leukemia, but I also find this picture of him about a year before he died at this temple in India somewhere, and I think that's where he got that book and plotted coming back as Jacques. And Jacques knows I'm onto him, and I start wondering what he's going to do to me, if he's going to try to get rid of me somehow. So I start acting extra careful, making sure he can't get me into trouble somehow. But he's smart. You need to be in school forever to get a PhD, you know. And I don't know how much he retained from his life as a man, but Jacques definitely has my number by this time. Then I have this crazy dream one night. At least, I think it's a dream. Jacques is speaking to me, and what I know is Greg's voice, since I found some clips of him online from academic conferences where he gave presentations. And he's telling me that Amber is his, and he's gonna find a way to get rid of me. And I know this shouldn't be scary since it's more like a Disney movie with a fucking talking cat, but I wake up in a cold sweat with my heart pounding out of my chest, and the cat staring at me like it all really happened. And maybe it did. I don't say anything to Amber through any of this. Just keep acting like everything's fine, and she has a perfectly normal asshole of a cat versus a dead husband reincarnated as a cat. I know I'd sound crazy, and she wouldn't like that I'm snooping around trying to find things out about Greg and looking at all the articles he wrote and listening to all of his recorded lectures and stuff. But then, one day, I'm chilling, watching the game, and she comes home from work. And before she even gives me a kiss, she's calling for her precious little Jacques. So I go back to watching TV. I don't even realize how much time has passed until she's standing in front of me screaming and crying. And I'm just like, what? She says I left the back door open and Jacques is gone. Like, out of the house gone. And that he could be lying dead on the side of the road somewhere because he's not an outside cat and doesn't know how crossing the street works. And part of me thinks how peaceful it would be without Jacques, but I know not to say that, just like I know I didn't leave the door open. I know he did it to frame me. 3 days. 3 days Amber's sobbing every night, missing him, giving me the cold shoulder. I'm trying to do all the good boyfriend stuff. Put up flyers, you know, contact rescue centers. Somebody calls us and we go to meet them, but it's some other black cat. I would have been happy to take any other cat home and just pretend it's Jacques, so I even try to make her think it is him. But she gets all pissed off, like how could I possibly think this scraggly thing is her sweet baby? And I'm hoping this dude isn't also a man reincarnated, because it's pretty harsh to say that about him when he's just a poor stray cat with no one to love him. So, Jacques is still gone, and I try to cheer Amber up, Bring her Starbucks and stuff. Give her a foot massage. The whole nine. But she's livid with me, even though I'm innocent. And we're sitting in the living room, me finally getting pissed off that she's blaming me, her crying and snotting everywhere. And then we hear this scratch at the door. So I get up to open the door, and there's that cocky little bastard, looking roughed up and dirty, and he just runs into the house and launches himself onto her lap. It's this big, tearful reunion between them, so I go over, thinking I'll get back into Amber's good graces. I go to pet Jacques, and he lunges at me, scratching my hand. But Amber doesn't fawn all over me like when Jacques bit me that first time I came over. She's all like, "I knew it. I knew you didn't like him. I knew you let him out." She's up on her feet, her face all scrunched up and red, tears and mucus streaking her face, shouting, cursing at me. And I'm pretty much in shock, since I still didn't even do anything to the damn cat. But I look over and see the cat laughing at me. I try to reason with her, try to make her see it was Jacques trying to come between us, and I spill the beans about Greg and how he found out how to come back to her. She looks at me like I'm a lunatic, so I give her all my proof, and she goes all still before telling me we're done. She gives me to the end of that week to move out. So, that's that, and Jacques/Greg gets the girl. Yeah, I know you have other customers, but I'm your best one, right? And can I get one more beer, man? Just trying to take the edge off before I head home to my shitty new apartment where I'm sleeping on a futon since I sold my place and got rid of my furniture. Thanks, man. That fucking cat. You've been listening to Not a Cat Guy by Cassandra O'Sullivan Satcher. Cassandra O'Sullivan Satcher is a writer and associate English professor in Pennsylvania who teaches creative writing and composition classes. She is the author of the novel Darkness There, But Something More. Visit her website at CassandraO'SullivanSatcher.com. Now, to close out our evening, I present When Dusk Falls by T.W. Grimm. Sunset over Hadley Township is almost always picture perfect, no matter what time of year it is. It's doubtful that anyone would disagree with that statement, not if they've ever witnessed the event firsthand. However, most people in these parts would argue that the sunset is at its most stunning in the summertime. In mid-July, Hadley Township is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and when the pink-laced gold of the early evening sky begins to deepen into the dark crimson shades of dusk, it could be mistaken for the Garden of Eden. Soon enough, all the lawns will begin to sizzle and die beneath the oppressive glare of the August sun, but for now, the grass is green and the meadows are dense and lush with the bounty of summer. Aside from its natural beauty, Hadley is basically a desolate patch of wilderness, a rural municipality with a total population of just under 2,000 souls. It's a place without tourist attractions or major urban centers, mostly consisting of forest, farmland, and towering blue sky. There are a few scattered hamlets within its borders, but most of them are basically just a collection of houses surrounding a wide spot in the road. They might boast a gas station, a variety store, or maybe even a small bank, but never all three. Hadley Township is said to be blessed, and after taking in the spectacular sunset, it would be hard to disagree with that statement. A blessing, however, can sometimes also be a curse. On this particular evening, Roger Mosley is out cutting the grass on his riding lawnmower, a never-ending task when one lives on a farm. He notices that the shadows are starting to lengthen and realizes that it's high time to call it quits on mowing for the evening. He parks the mower in the barn and takes a wander around the barnyard to look for his daughter. Even though it's still relatively early in the evening, it's time for her to get inside. Normally, he'd let her stay out late enough to go chasing after fireflies. But not tonight. Tonight, everyone has to be inside before dusk. Roger has lived on this farm his entire life, and he's grateful for his quiet, honest existence. The farm is successful and has always turned a profit, The modest prosperity of the land stretches back for 10 generations. Family roots run deep in Hadley Township. Most of the farmers still plow the same fields that their ancestors cleared with an axe over 200 years ago, and Roger was no different. He was born a Hadley man, and he would die a Hadley man. Roger finds Sadie and Rufus at the edge of the cornfield, chasing after butterflies in the slanting sun rays, identical grins plastered on their faces. Both the girl and the dog have been stained green by the fresh-cut grass. He brings them up to the house and sends them inside for Katie to deal with, answering her annoyance with a meek little shrug. She kneels down to give them both a mock scolding at eye level, her hands planted firmly on her generous hips and a smile threatening to break out and spread across her face. Sadie and Rufus look down at the carpet and shuffle their feet, enduring Katie's lecture with pouting defiance.
"I'll be in soon," he says. "Gonna have a smoke."
Katie gives her husband a small nod over the top of Sadie's sweaty, tousled head. A look passes between them. "Don't be too long," she tells him softly. "Tonight's the night." Roger takes a walk around the house, frowning at the uneven lawn and lighting a hand-rolled cigarette with a match. He notes that the cut looks pretty ragged. The mower blades must be getting dull. He stands in his front yard and watches as the western half of the sky begins to glow with a gentle golden hue, the bright blue slowly giving way to shades of amber and rose. He looks up at the sky for a long, long time, motionless and tense, and his rollie gradually burns into a forgotten tower of ashes between his fingers. We leave Roger Mosley standing in his front yard and travel west down County Road 22, chasing after the setting sun. We pass endless parcels of rustling cornfields, all of them standing well over 8 feet in height. The soil in Hadley Township is renowned throughout the county as being uncommonly rich and fertile. If a Hadley man were to sell his farmstead to an outsider, it would fetch a pretty penny above market value, but it's unlikely that will ever happen. There hasn't been a sale of land within township lines in well over 200 years. The landscape is dominated by the surnames Mosley, Van Doren, Borden, and Weir. They are emblazoned onto mailboxes and road signs all across the township, as well as appearing in the names of public schools, bridges, nature reserves, and a dozen different little hamlets. Even garbage dumps and transfer stations bear the mark of the four original families, the oldest bloodlines in the municipality. The entire historical patchwork of Hadley Township is threaded together with these names, and there's hardly a single acre that hasn't been owned by one of these families during the span of the past 2 centuries. Interwoven family trees and their equally complicated claims on the land have turned Hadley into a very close-knit corner of the world, which is exactly how they want it. The people here take care of their own. Outsiders are tolerated, but they are never truly welcomed. Hadley is a place of uncommon beauty, but it is also a place of secrets. The massive cornfields come to an end at the corner of County Road 22 and Weir Line. From there, there's a 3-mile stretch of land on either side of the 22 that has been divided into a number of large private lots. The majority of these lots are occupied by homeowners, but a few small businesses can be found in the mix, mom-and-pop operations that are run by local residents. Not everyone in Hadley is a farmer. There is a small but thriving business community here as well, enterprises that vary from pet groomers and candle makers to car mechanics and machine shops. All of them are at least modestly successful. Here, we meet Brian Caldwell, the owner and proprietor of a small supply warehouse for landscaping materials, a one-man operation with the decidedly unimaginative name Caldwell Landscaping Supply. Although it is currently the height of landscaping season, Brian called all of his own suppliers earlier in the day and canceled his pending orders. He then flipped the sign on the door from open to closed, turned off the lights, and sat down on the floor in the middle of his showroom. He is still sitting there now, slumped over in the gloom as the sun lowers in the sky and the shadows stretch their skeletal arms to the east. Brian Caldwell has gone insane, which is not an unusual occurrence in Hadley Township. In fact, it happens all the time. People around these parts have their secrets, it's true, but there are a number of people in the township who are unaware of its old traditions, Brian being one of them. His father had known them all too well, but Rick Caldwell had always taken great care to shield his sons from certain facts regarding the true nature of their little corner of the world. Even still, Hadley is one of those places where an uncomfortable sort of psychic residue seems to linger in the air. It rasps away at the back of the mind, a low and unpleasant itching of the subconscious that makes people extra irritable during the long, hot days of August, and downright mean when the temperatures plummet in the month of January. Unfortunately, some people are naturally more sensitive to this low-key mental assault than others, and Brian Caldwell is unlucky enough to be such an individual. Over the course of the past few weeks, Brian has become convinced that the moon is actually the staring eye of an ancient beast, an evil presence that dwells in the howling void, which exists somewhere just beyond the reaches of outer space. Brian believes that the beast watches our world every night with its jealous eye, hungering for our destruction. His delusion began as a nagging little notion in the back of his mind, a soft, insistent whisper, but it quickly inflated into an all-encompassing paranoia that occupies Brian's every waking thought, every single minute of the day. Nobody knows about Brian's increasingly volatile mental state or the nature of his delusion. At first, he refrained from telling anyone because he was afraid people would think he was crazy, but as his strange new conviction sank its poisonous hooks deeper into his mind, Brian began to fear that his friends and customers might actually be servants of the evil eye, agents who spy on him and report their observations back to their nocturnal master when the sun goes down. Brian decided that it was imperative to hide his newfound awareness from the people around him. He became quiet and watchful, glaring out at the world through bloodshot eyes, squinted and bleary under the weight of his constant suspicion. Brian has been awake for almost 100 hours. Sleep is an impossible feat. Recently, the eye has developed the ability to see right through the roof of his house, and at night he can actually feel the thing's loathsome gaze crawling across his trembling body, coveting his very existence. Dawn brings temporary relief, but the eye is always lurking just beyond the horizon, waiting for the heavens to grow cold and black in the wake of the waning sun, waiting for its chance to arise and stare hatefully into Brian's soul. Brian Caldwell became a time bomb waiting to go off, and this morning, the inevitable explosion finally came. As he sat at the kitchen table, staring blankly at the sunlight that was streaming through the east windows, Brian suddenly realized that his own wife was actually an agent of the beast, and so was his teenage daughter. The revelation hit him like a ton of bricks, and he let out a keening, whistling little gasp, his pallid face crumpling with grief and rage. All along, it had been his own fucking wife and kid, for Christ's sake. His own flesh and blood. Emmy asked, "Did you just say something, hon?" without looking up from the dishes, and Brian stared at her back, his fists clenched on the table on either side of his coffee mug. He tore his eyes away from the treacherous demon bitch and gazed back into the depths of the hazy morning sunbeams, his eyes narrowed into slits. Of course they were serving the eye. They had always served the eye. How had he been blind to this fact for so long? Brian got up from the table and crept up behind Emmy as she stood at the sink, his lips skinned back from his teeth in a rictus of hate. He took out his folding buck knife and pulled the blade. When he was done, Brian placed Emmy's head on the counter and stepped carefully over her body, trying his best to be stealthy and quiet. He tiptoed upstairs and pounced on Mary Beth as she was engaged in some last-minute fussing with her eyebrows in the bathroom mirror, rushing to get ready in time for school. Mary Beth fought him like the demon she really was, screeching and clawing. She managed to fend off her father's initial attack and bolted past him, running down the hallway with her hair streaming behind her and blood blooming like roses on the back of her shirt. Brian scrambled after her, his eyes bulging and his face crisscrossed with deep, oozing scratches. He was simultaneously grinning, crying, and snarling like a rabid dog.
"Did you think I'd never find out? Huh? Did you?"
Brian tackled his daughter at the top of the staircase and pinned her to the floor of the hallway. He pushed the side of her head into the carpet, and she wailed,
"No, Daddy, please! Please don't hurt me!"
He ignored the monster's trickery and plunged his knife into her neck, sinking it right up to the hilt. The blade pushed between two of Mary Beth's cervical vertebrae and severed her spinal cord. She abruptly stopped thrashing beneath him, and he finished the job in relative peace, sawing through her throat with no more emotion than if he'd been slicing into a particularly tough cut of rare steak. It was gruesome work, but that was how it had to be done. Brian knew this to be true because a sunbeam had told him so in the kitchen. It spoke to him in the patterns it made with the dancing motes of dust in the air, the arrangements of the shapes projected onto the linoleum as it shone through the east windows. Sunlight is golden. Sunlight is salvation. Brian knew this to be the truth. The whole thing was kind of a big relief, really. After long weeks of fear and confusion, it was finally all crystal clear. He'd been right all along. The darkness belongs to the eye of the beast, and sunbeams never tell lies. We leave Brian sitting there on the cold concrete floor of his showroom, his arms wrapped tightly around his knees, and we continue on with our journey. The sun is almost touching the horizon now, and the heavens above have been painted with broad strokes of red and gold. We backtrack to Weir Line and head north. It isn't long before an old church appears up on the right-hand side of the road, tucked cozily between a field of soybeans and a field of corn. It's a non-denominational house of worship that goes by the name the Church of Welcoming Dawn, which is where Pastor Jonathan Borden can be found on most Sunday mornings and on Wednesday evenings, the night he hosts a weekly Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Pastor John is currently sitting at his desk in the small office at the back of the church, reading through a passage in the Good Book and scribbling down notes in a binder full of lined paper. The Bible he is studying is unusual in appearance. It is a large, imposing tome that weighs almost 10 pounds, bound in faded leather and likely printed by means of a wooden printing press. This Bible has been in use at the church for more than 200 years, and it has never been handled by anyone except the pastors of Welcoming Dawn, local men who have dedicated their lives to administering to the spiritual needs of the citizens of Hadley Township. The Bible is written in an alphabet that predates Latin by almost 3,000 years, a language long dead to the rest of the world. Pastor John began his instruction on how to decipher the strange-looking runes when he was still a boy, tutored after school every day by dour old Pastor Will, the man who had preceded him as head of the church. Pastor Will taught young Jonathan how to divine the deeper meanings behind the passages written in their Good Book, and showed him how he could relay God's word to the rest of the congregation with his sermons. The most important lesson imparted on young John during these formative years, however, was to always obey the word of the Lord. Always, without question or hesitation. Pastor Will would often say, "The Lord has generously blessed our little community with fertility and good fortune, as He is a kind and loving God. But He can also be an unforgiving God. Never forget that, Jonathan. Never." Pastor Will stressed to him on a near daily basis that it is the duty of mankind to praise Him, to satisfy his demands in the manner that has been laid out in detail in the Good Book. He darkly warned that woe will soon befall those who turn their backs on the will of the Lord, woe and suffering beyond imagining. Pastor John is currently struggling to write a sermon for his next service. The theme of the sermon is highly ironic to him: deliverance. He studies on the subject of deliverance quite often, although not in the manner you might expect. John Borden yearns for a personal deliverance from the grave responsibilities and even graver consequences of his life as the head of the church. Sitting there at his desk with the fading light streaming in through the west window, Jonathan closes his eyes and tries to imagine what life would be like if he had been born completely free and unbeholden to anything or anyone. Free to wander, free to think or feel in any manner he might choose from one hour to the next. He scrubs his hands across his face and blinks down at his notes. He imagines setting the pages in the binder on fire, then using them as a torch to spread the blaze around the entire damnable church. He smiles to himself, a bitter twist of his lips. He wouldn't dare do such a thing. Not ever. He is trapped by virtue of his bloodline. There will be no deliverance, not for Pastor John. He will serve the church until the end of his days. The alternative is too awful for him to even contemplate. The Lord who watches over Hadley Township is unforgiving. His will must be obeyed. We still have one more stop to make before nightfall, so we leave the church and continue north on Weir Line until we reach a large patch of old-growth forest, a wild and rambling area that the locals refer to as Mossley Woods. We hang a right onto Blackmore Road, a glorified gravel lumber road that is in decidedly poor condition. Most Hadley residents avoid it like the plague, claiming that it's far too bedeviled by deep potholes and soft, crumbling shoulders to be safe for travel. Taking your vehicle onto Blackmore Road is a great way to bust a tie rod or bitch up your alignment if you aren't careful. Although it is true that the road isn't worth a damn, it's not really the potholes that people wish to avoid. It's Mossley Woods. It is thick and vast and forbidding. People have been known to get lost in there. People have been known to disappear in there entirely. We follow Blackmore's meandering northwesterly path through the woods. It's already getting dark down here at ground level, but high above our heads, the treetops glow like ripe summer wheat in the fading daylight. Dusk is almost upon us. There is a dirt path coming up on the left, peeking out from between a birch tree and a tangle of wild raspberries. You could easily miss it if you didn't know where to look. The path isn't much wider than a single vehicle, and it's in even worse shape than Blackmore Road, heavily rutted from years of ice, floodwaters, and erosion. We follow it into the woods and discover that the rough little patch is actually someone's driveway. That someone is Kurt Weir, an elderly recluse with a sour and unpleasant disposition. Kurt has just awoken from his afternoon drunk and is feeling a bit under the weather, but there's no time to piss and moan about his aching head. He has work to do. Kurt is 74 years old, a gangly scarecrow of a man who is blind in one eye and mostly deaf on the same side. He suffered these injuries back in the fall of 87, the result of standing a tad too close to a leaky moonshine still that decided to explode. Old Kurt still lives in the same dilapidated shanty that he built almost half a century ago, a tar paper shack with rusty aluminum siding nailed to the roof. He is the proud owner of several old Chevy trucks, all of which are decaying on cement blocks in the dirt patch that serves as his front yard. He is also something of a scrap metal enthusiast, who hoards large quantities of rusty iron rebar, steel beams, crates full of brass doorknobs, and other such metallic detritus. His property is a safety hazard of jagged metal and random piles of rubble. Kurt has lived in seclusion in his remote little shanty for so long that most of the younger generations don't even know that he exists. The old-timers, those who are still sharp enough to remember that far back, could tell you that old Kurt had purchased the 7-acre woodlot from Roger Mossley Sr. for a song back in 67, just a few scant months after his young wife tragically died in a car accident. Nancy Weir had lost control of her vehicle early on a Sunday morning and hit a telephone pole out on the 22, not more than 3 miles from the Hadley-Elbin border. Nancy had been doing at least 60 miles an hour when her Oldsmobile careened off the road and smashed into the pole. She was given a closed casket funeral. What the old-timers won't tell you is that there had been a short police investigation following Nancy's death.
A number of the injuries the coroner found on Nancy's body were inconsistent to what would be expected from a fatal car accident. There were also questions regarding the state of the Oldsmobile's brake lines. Kurt Weir was soon paid a visit by a detective from the Burton County Homicide Unit, a stone-faced Irishman named Sean O'Connell. Kurt's answers to O'Connell's veiled accusations were sparse and well-rehearsed. Frustrated by his inability to sweat a confession out of his suspect, the detective tried questioning Weir's closest neighbors. His inquiries were met with a brick wall of sullen, hostile silence. Unable to build a solid case, O'Connell was eventually pressured into throwing in the towel. Nancy's death was ruled an accident. Despite the county's official stance on the matter, Detective O'Connell never actually stopped working on the case. Nancy Weir had been murdered and was likely dead before she was placed behind the wheel of the Oldsmobile. She'd been torn apart, ripped and mutilated by a curved instrument with a sharp point. O'Connell believed that the murder weapon was a meat hook. There was no doubt in his mind that if he'd been able to obtain a search warrant, he would have found such an instrument hidden somewhere in the farmhouse the Weirs had been renting from Gilbert Van Doren, Kurt's uncle through marriage. At first, the detective assumed that Kurt's motive was the insurance payout. But after a while, he began to suspect that Nancy's murder was part of some greater, even more sinister conspiracy. He'd seen it in the eyes of the people he'd attempted to interview. They all had the blank, closed-off stare of someone who had grown accustomed to guarding a dangerous secret. O'Connell did some digging around and discovered that the Reeve of Hadley Township had personally paid a retaining fee to secure the services of a hotshot trial lawyer from the city. Why would the Reeve of the township hire a lawyer for a man who hadn't been officially charged with a crime, let alone the likes of Kurt Weir? He was white trash, an alcoholic, chronically unemployed ne'er-do-well. It seemed highly unlikely that a man like that would have friends in such high places. It was also doubtful that foggy-headed Kurt could have orchestrated the accident on his own. Someone helped him do it. But who? And for God's sake, why? Detective O'Connell kept searching for the answers to these questions for 5 long years, right up until the day he died of a massive heart attack at the police station. His colleagues found him sitting upright at his desk, his eyes bulging from their sockets and his mouth open to let out a scream. A copy of the previous year's census for Hadley Township was clutched in one of his hands. There was an open notebook in front of him, and he'd scrawled the words, "Connected by blood," on the page so hard that the paper had torn beneath the tip of his pen. Kurt trudges out back to feed the livestock, a few sheep and goats that he keeps in a dilapidated pen behind his shack. He used to keep a few hens and a rooster, too, back when he could still eat eggs. But these days, Kurt sustains himself mostly on a diet of meal replacement drinks, oatmeal, and whiskey, and the coop stands empty. The livestock are not for meat or milk. They serve a higher purpose. Kurt watches the snarfling, jostling beasts as they feed, and he randomly picks out one of the nannies. The number and nature of the beasts that he must put out into the dusk comes to him in his dreams, usually several nights beforehand. Tonight, it will be a single goat. The billy goat has been granted perpetual exemption from the process. Kurt has developed a sort of grudging affection for the mean little bastard and doesn't have the heart to put him out into the dusk. He decided a while ago that he'll just let the foul-tempered creature idle the rest of his days away in the pen, eating oats and kicking the living hell out of any creature that dares to venture too close. The billy's demeanor reminds Kurt of himself, to the point where the old man has affectionately christened him Kurt Jr. Kurt Jr. is the first animal that Kurt has bothered to name in a good long while. The ranks of the livestock change too often to care much about who is who. Jimmy Van Doren's half-wit son Dougie comes bumping down Blackmore Road in his father's cattle truck every month or so, bringing out new animals as needed. Kurt makes sure that he always has at least 3 goats and as many sheep on hand at all times. He knows through personal experience that it's very bad to be caught short. Very bad indeed. There are repercussions. Kurt Weir is the 7th son of a man who was himself a 7th son,
the lineage going back over 10 generations. He has the dreams, and he brings the animals into the woods to suffer their fate. This is Kurt's inherited duty, and it has cost him dearly. The livestock are extremely skittish of leaving the safety of their pen. They refuse to approach the gate unless lured by some unfamiliar and exotic-looking treat. Kurt rips a clump of dandelions from the hard-packed soil in the yard and coaxes the nanny goat by waving them around and crooning, "Come over here and get the pretty yellow things, goat. Tasty pretty yellow things. Come on now." The nanny cautiously creeps in a little closer, and Kurt swings open the gate. He bares his scant collection of caramel corn teeth and what's meant to be a disarming smile and makes kissy noises at her, dandelions in one hand and a rope knotted into a noose in the other. "That's it. Come on out and get them pretty yellow things. That's a good girl." The goat balks at crossing the threshold. She lowers her head and bleats, tensing to flee if the old man tries to grab her. Kurt starts pretending to eat the dandelions, smacking his lips and exclaiming at just how damned good they are, until the goat's curiosity finally outweighs her fear, and she delicately tiptoes out of the pen. The little goat stretches her neck out to chomp down on the bobbing dandelion heads, and Kurt throws the noose around it, snapping it tight with a practiced flick of his wrist. The goat lets out a garbled-sounding shriek and tries to back away, but Kurt yanks the panicked creature off her feet, pins her to the ground beneath his rubber boot, and strangles her with the noose. He asphyxiates the poor creature until her struggles weaken and taper off into a few random twitches of her back legs, then eases the tension on the rope. It simply wouldn't do to bring out an animal that was unconscious or dying. They have to be both alive and aware when the sun slips past the horizon. These are the rules, and to deliberately break the rules was unthinkable. Kurt gives the goat a few minutes to recover, whistling tunelessly and staring off into space as he waits. When it seems as though the gasping little nanny will be strong enough to stand on her own, he hauls her upright and begins to lead her into the woods, still whistling his tuneless song. You can pick out enough of the melody to recognize that the song is "Last Kiss" by J. Frank Wilson and the Cavaliers, the song that Kurt and Nancy had their first dance to at their wedding. It was supposed to be "Blue Moon," but the elderly gent who was hired to spin the records that night accidentally put on the wrong record. He was more of a Guy Lombardo sort of man and didn't really know the difference. Kurt and Nancy laughed it off and swayed around together in the basement of the Legion in Paul's Mills, smiling for the cameras as their guests hooted and clapped and banged their fists on fold-out tables. Happy with the positive reaction it got, the old fella spun that little 45 over and over again that night, and Kurt's pretty young wife grew more enchanting in his eyes each time it was played. Kurt brings the goat to the sacred knoll, a journey that seems to get longer and longer with each successive full moon. He ties her to a post that has been sunk deep into the top of the little hill and leaves her there, bleating mournfully after him in the gathering darkness. When he was a younger man, Kurt used to feel a certain kind of sadness for the animals he left behind for the Lord. Nowadays, he feels nothing for them at all. All the bad feelings are reserved solely for himself and the faded memories of his lost love, who was taken from him by the good Lord on a foggy, rainy night in 1967. The Lord is unforgiving, and the Lord is vengeful. Kurt knows this to be true from personal experience. He is the seventh son of a seventh son, and his task is a grim one, but the repercussions of failing in this task are far, far worse. Kurt trudges back to his leaning little shack, still whistling his sad little tune. We leave him to his bottle and his inner demons. The sun has slipped below the horizon. Dusk has fallen on Hadley Township, and the moon now dominates the night sky overhead, full and bloated. It really does resemble an evil eye, a dead, milky eye that glares down on our world with cold, hateful glee. All across Hadley Township, people have locked themselves in their houses and pulled their curtains shut. They retire to bed early and restlessly wait for sleep to come, yearning for the welcoming dawn that will drive away the dreaded darkness that shrouds the fragile shell of their existence. The goat bleats and cries in the distance. An hour passes by, then another, and then there is the sound of powerful wings beating the air overhead. A stench of brimstone and corruption assails our nostrils. The goat begins to cry out with renewed vigor, fighting to escape the noose around its neck, strangling itself in a state of terrified panic. The moon is momentarily blotted out by a long, serpentine shape. There is a split-second impression of gigantic bat wings and gaping jaws, and then the goat begins to scream. The screams abruptly stop. The flapping wings disturb the stillness of the night once more, and then all is silent. The will of the Lord has been satisfied. The people of Hadley Township will live to welcome the dawn once again. You've just heard When Dusk Falls by T.W. Grimm. T.W. Grimm is a reclusive author of horror and various other genres of dark fiction. He resides in southwestern Ontario. And with that, my friends, we close out our broadcast evening. Thanks to Cassandra O'Sullivan Satcher and T.W. Grimm for their stories this evening. I'll remind you to go check out more of their work over at Velox Books, www.veloxbooks.com. And also, thanks to you, dear listeners, for coming back again to Horror Hill. We have another episode lined up for you next week, so be sure to come back at the same day and time for more scary stories in this Halloween season. Until next time, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.